Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. What does a doctor who works in an intensive care unit with all the whistles and bells of modern medicine have in common with a palliative care physician whose practice revolves almost entirely around conversation? At first glance, not much. But my guest today, who's transitioned from one role to the other, engaged in deep reflection about what really mattered to him on his journey in the profession of medicine. John Hendricks is the Medical Director of Palliative Care Services and Hospice at St. John Medical Center here in Tulsa. He's spent nearly all of his career working as a hospital-based physician, most recently with a specific focus on the intensive care unit before making the switch to palliative care. In our conversation today, we'll explore the thinking and emotion behind his change in practice setting and also better define the scope of palliative care and why today it's more important than ever and vastly underutilized. We'll also discuss the time Dr. Hendricks and I indirectly corresponded over a patient, an elderly woman with a hip fracture, and how through the lens of palliative care we came to opposite conclusions about what the best course of action would be for her, which illustrates the truism that there are no right answers when it comes to medical ethics. Dr. John Hendricks is my guest today for Studio Tulsa on Health. John Hendricks, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I want to start just by asking you to define what palliative care is. You're a medical director of the Palliative Care Services. What's involved?
Palliative care is a specialty of medicine primarily dealing with supportive care, symptom control for patients who have chronic illnesses or terminal diseases, any life-threatening illness. It's a multidisciplinary approach where we have nursing, social workers, chaplains, pharmacists that help us take and manage these patients through, you know, really difficult time in their life.
These are typically people who are pretty sick with maybe a terminal illness, but not always.
Not always. Some of the illnesses we have are life-threatening illnesses, such as septic shock in the ICU, respiratory failure that may not have a chronic illness. We also deal with some of the more chronic illnesses for patients who are primarily getting admitted to the hospital multiple times.
Now, you're also, as part of your medical directorship, you lead the St. John Hospice, which is really, how is hospice separate from palliative care? Or is there a helpful way to think about that differently?
Palliative care can be involved with the patient anytime during the illness. Hospice is primarily the last 6 months of life, where essentially an attending physician and the medical director of hospice have deemed that you have a terminal illness and they think you have 6 months left to live. It's essentially the same treatments. It's just based on the time that the doctors think you have left to live.
Now, we were talking a little bit offline, and you mentioned that perhaps one of your frustrations in this role is that when other doctors consult you, that is when they ask for a palliative care service to come by and evaluate a patient or make recommendations, they're often doing it kind of what we euphemistically say late in the game. You'd like them to do it sort of earlier when you can be more effective in terms of providing comfort for a patient.
Right. Most of these patients can really benefit from palliative care earlier in their disease, especially patients who have, say, metastatic cancer. We can help improve quality of life. There's lots of evidence coming out that early palliative care may actually prolong patients' lives as well, and also help with anxiety, depression related to their diseases, and help with survivor guilt as far as the family goes.
So say more about that idea, and I've heard that in other places and read about it in the medical literature, but the idea that early palliative care can actually extend life, it sort of defies logic because you think of palliative care as providing comfort for people who are suffering, but the goal of care is more the comfort, say, than the cure. Is it this idea that we provide so much solace and treat pain and anxiety that therefore people just kind of live longer? Or do we know?
I don't know if we necessarily know. I think there's more to taking care of a patient than I think the physical ailments. There's the social aspect of taking care of the patient and the psychological. And having just a huge support system of medical providers coming into the home, especially for hospice patients, but prior to that, where you have someone that is basically treating you as a person and not necessarily as your disease. And we spend the time to get to know you as a person, and really we want to establish what's important to you, what do you understand about your disease. And as the patients go through this process and get sicker and sicker, sometimes the treatments are probably worse than the cure. And there was a recent study 3 weeks ago that patients who have 6 months left to live, oncology patients that get chemotherapy, their quality of life is worse. And those who were healthier and less disabled actually did worse in that 6 months than those who didn't seek aggressive therapy.
So are palliative care and then treating for cure, are those mutually exclusive? Or can a patient, in other words, be going for chemotherapy to treat a cancer but also seek palliation, as it were?
Yes, that's what the best thing is for these patients, I think, as far as how to treat them. And then the oncologist, we'll use them as an example, are very busy treating the cancer, but there's lots that go along with the cancer as far as anxiety, depression, the symptoms, nausea, and vomiting. And having a doctor who's focused, as well as a team focused on those issues related to the care, can really help. So I don't think they're exclusive of each other. I think actually the best way to do is they should treat synergistically together. We want to be involved from the moment you hear, and we are not here to try to talk the patient out of any therapies. Our job is basically to find out what they understand, tell them what options are available, and support them through whatever treatment choices they make.
So we have seen tremendous growth in the palliative care field, have we not, in the last, say, decade or two?
I would say that there's been a lot of growth. Most hospitals are now starting to see the value of palliative care involved with patient care. It's still really an inpatient and hospice-focused area. As far as being accessible to an outpatient and ambulatory setting, we don't really have that yet.
But at St. John Medical Center, where you are the medical director of palliative care, you were mentioning that as part of something called an ACO, an Accountable Care Organization for here in Northeast Oklahoma, I believe Oklahoma Health Initiative, you're working in cooperation with several other entities to try to bring palliative care to the outpatient world. Can you say more about that?
Right. Earlier this year, the Accountable Care Organization, the Oklahoma Health Initiative, has task force dedicated to certain patient populations, and one of those was the congestive heart failure as well as COPD patients.
Congestive heart failure is where the person's heart function is pretty poor, so
right.
They get fluid essentially in their lungs and their body due to sort of poor heart function. When you hear heart failure, you think immediately die, but people can live with this as a chronic condition with varying degrees of severity. And COPD, of course, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease like emphysema,
right.
Pretty much.
So as they were looking into these, they created these task force, and most of these patients end up dying from their disease. It is a terminal diagnosis, and they didn't feel like they were able to really address those issues with their patients. And many of those doctors are not comfortable treating shortness of breath or pain. Those are not what they typically deal with. The pulmonologists do, but they have a set treatment. Many of these patients actually respond to treatments that we use, which are primarily opioid medications to help them. The pulmonologist, the cardiologist don't prescribe those and don't feel comfortable. So they asked us what we thought, and we thought what would be best is to start a supportive care clinic inside those individual clinics. So the physicians would actually start to refer their patients, their sickest patients, to us, and we would meet with them, spend an hour that first time and probably 30 minutes in subsequent visits talking to them about what all's going on, not their heart failure, but what symptoms they're suffering from, be it depression, anxiety, nausea, vomiting, that kind of stuff, and we can start treating those. The other goal is to talk to them about advanced care planning, really what's important to them. Do they want to spend more time in the hospital or do they want to spend more time at home? Are they appropriate for hospice? Talk to them about hospice. That's primarily our goal, and the hope is that this will be successful, and then we can have our own individual clinic where physicians can start referring to us.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher today. My guest is Dr. John Hendricks. He's the Medical Director of Palliative Care Services at St. John Medical Center, as well as the St. John Hospice. And you started your career, I believe, as a hospitalist, right, as a hospitalist physician. So ironic in a way that you're now maybe going back to the outpatient world doing this kind of work in the clinic or even, you said, sometimes in the home care setting.
Right. It's going to be new for me. I have been a hospital-based doctor my entire career. As soon as I left residency, I started at St. Francis as a hospitalist and then moved over to St. John in 2008, served there as a non-ICU hospitalist for 4 years and then an intensive care hospitalist for 2 years and then went into the palliative care. I haven't done clinics since residency, so it'll be definitely a challenge for me as well as my partner. He's a hospital-based doctor as well. We're looking forward to it. I think we're going to be able to provide a service that the community really needs.
Well, so let's explore that just a little bit. Now, you said for a while you were an ICU hospitalist. That stands for intensive care unit. So you were taking care of, for at least a couple of years, the sickest patients known to doctors, known to anybody, who are often, you know, are in specialized units, often sedated, often on breathing machines, doing the breathing for them, sometimes with things like heart pumps and other, you know, ventricular assist devices and things. So very complicated medical patients, and that's highly technological. And now you've made this transition to palliative care, which focuses on symptom control. So in a sense, away from that kind of aggressive technological approach to the more if you will, more conversational, because that's a very key part of it. You said, talking about goal setting, advanced care planning, you know, goals of care discussions. How did that transition come about? It's fascinating.
I always liked critical care medicine. It was something I always thought about doing, especially since I was a medical student on through residency. But I also liked the palliative care. Part of the way I got there was the way that the St. John Hospitals program was set up, was that we had a group of doctors that I was responsible for. Instead of one large pool of doctors, I had five or six that I would see his patients. After a while, I kept seeing the same patients over and over. And the other rule we had set up is that if a patient returned to the hospital in 3 months, we were responsible for their care. So I got to see these patients, and I started thinking, why am I doing this to some of these patients, especially like patients who were already severely demented, didn't know who they were, and they kept coming in from the nursing home, or COPD patients or heart failure patients. And I got asked to move into the ICU while I was waiting for a palliative care position to open up at the hospital. And I said, yes, that sounds fine, and ended up doing that for 2 years. But I don't think critical care and palliative care are exclusive either. A lot of what we deal with is end of life in the ICU, and you have to have very difficult conversations. So the palliative care interest I had and the need and the one I wanted to do for it actually went really well in the ICU. I was able to have a lot of these difficult conversations, more than any of us really ever want to have in the ICU. So that's kind of how I ended up in the ICU.
So it really is interesting. In some ways, they seem like polar opposites with regard to their level of technological intervention. And yet, I think as you point out, they're really sort of different sides of a very similar coin. You know, as you said, I want to sort of press you further on the question of you never wanting to have those conversations in an ICU. Can you elaborate on that? I mean, I think I know what you mean, but you basically never want to get in the scenario where you are critically ill or your loved one is critically ill and you haven't discussed if someone might be dying or, you know, unfortunately very sick or through an accident or through the progression of a chronic illness. You want to have kind of at least discussed those things beforehand.
Yeah. At first, I think all doctors, we always want to see the patient get better and go home. In the ICU setting, we don't see that. And a lot of what we end up seeing is complications related to these terminal diseases. The most difficult part of the job is many people do not plan for this. They don't realize that their disease is slowly taking their life or sometimes suddenly taking their life, and they don't have these conversations with families. So it's very important for the ICU doctor to sit and talk with the family and kind of get a sense of who the patient is. Has the patient ever made any comments, offhand comments? And I like to use the term of advocating for the patients. I asked the family members if they could hear what I was telling them about the condition of the patient and what we expect to happen, what would they want? And then they're just relaying that information to me. And that tends to help the families as far as any guilt goes, or like, I've got to do this. I've got to keep pressing forward for so-and-so. And I think that kind of relaxed them and took some of that guilt off of them. I really wish that more people would do advanced care planning, advanced directives, talk about their code status if they want to be intubated, if they wanted dialysis and feeding tubes, especially in this state that requires feeding tubes if you don't have an advanced directive or have told your physician you don't want one.
Yeah, and I think part of that burden is that essentially humans are very good at denial, so we don't want to ever admit or think about that kind of scenario. And then another thing is it does seem like a legal encumbrance. When we talk about advanced directives, it's a jargony type of a thing that I think doctors and lawyers deal with, maybe even on a daily basis. But it sounds, I think, probably to our listeners like, oh, it's something I have to talk to a lawyer about, or it's complicated, or I have to read a pamphlet or a textbook and then kind of answer questions. What really is involved? I mean, how simple is it? It could be a lot simpler than I think we present it as sometimes.
I think it's really simple in the fact that you're essentially given three options. The most important thing to understand is that the advance directive doesn't kick in unless you cannot make that decision anymore. That means for some reason the physicians have felt that you're no longer able to communicate with them, be it you're confused, you've had a stroke. And then it's simple options and I want everything done. I want nothing done, but I do want food and water, or I don't want anything done. And it's under these three situations. And the other thing, it allows you to place someone in charge of you if you're in that situation, which we call a healthcare proxy. You know, we don't want to do anything to you that you don't want us to do. many times we don't have that information sitting in front of us as physicians, especially in the hospital, because most of the times we've never met you before. And so having that information, even if we haven't determined that the advance directive kicks in, can at least guide our decisions talking with the family.
And so the default option then is, of course, to do everything. You're going to, as we say, err on the side of life.
Right.
But it's worth pointing out that performing or creating an advance directive doesn't require a lawyer. It really is something you can do. There's forms that you can print out or the hospital can provide you with one.
Right. You don't have to – it doesn't have to be notarized. It doesn't have to have an attorney. All you have to do is have two witnesses that are essentially not a provider, not a family member, and not someone who could potentially inherit something. So two of your buddies can go download the form off the internet. Oklahoma has an advance directive form. All three of you can fill them out for each other, and then you just keep that somewhere and give a copy to your doctor.
I want to also follow up on another principle that you mentioned, which I think in medical ethics, the fancy term, we call it substituted judgment. And this is something where that scenario that you've been in, that I've also been in, where a patient is very ill in the ICU and unable to speak for themselves or unable to make a medical decision due to confusion or a medical condition. And too often, I think the family member is ill at ease making a decision, which they think they're making a decision for their loved one, which they are. But in fact, we try to give them this idea of substitute judgment. In other words, what would so-and-so, what would mom, what would dad, what would brother, sister want? And framing it in that context can take away a little bit of the burden, the decision-maker burden or the guilt. If we know that the decision that we're trying to act upon is in concordance with the loved one's wish, then it's really not our decision. We're really merely executing the decision that our loved one has made or has discussed at a previous opportunity.
Correct.
And too often we don't have those discussions to even know what our loved ones want.
That's true. We don't. And doing this job, I haven't even really had that discussion with all of my loved ones. Recently, a book came out called Being Mortal by Atul Gawande that I gave to my father and said, you need to read this. Read it and then tell me what you think. My dad doesn't like to have these discussions, and he knows what his son does. My mother doesn't like to have them either. So it is a difficult conversation to have with family, but I think it's important so we can take care of our family members when that time does come and treat them with the dignity and the respect that they want.
Being Mortal is a brilliantly written book by Gawande, who you mentioned, who writes for The New Yorker. He's a surgeon. And in that book, which is really as much a memoir as it is an exploration of end-of-life care in America, he talks about his own father, who's also a physician. So he and his father, both physicians, struggle with his father's illness. And I think one of the key points that you can take away from that is not only is denial a strong impulse, but the idea that once you make an advance directive, somehow it's irrevocable. And what we fail to, I think, educate people on is you can change your mind. And I think Gawande's father actually did change his mind. He had certain conceptions of how he would, you know, as he got more infirm through his illness and he had an advanced cancer that spread throughout his body, he had notions of what he would and wouldn't accept. But as he got to that point, he changed his mind, and that was okay. And it seems like he got a lot more life than he maybe bargained for at the outset.
Yeah, he did. And I have an advance directive, and when I filled mine out, I didn't have children. I now have two small kids, and I think differently about how I would want to necessarily live my life. I think if I was able to at least be able to interact with my kids somewhat, that would be good life for me. Before my kids, if I wasn't able to go out with my friends and go travel, that's not the life I want. And our priorities change as we age and as things happen to us in our lives. And an advance directive can be stopped at any time. You just have to tell us, don't use that advance directive. And as we get sick, our priorities change. And some people are like, I don't want to be kept alive in those situations. So it's important that the physicians and family are having these discussions throughout life.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher today. My guest is Dr. John Hendricks. He's the Medical Director of Palliative Care Services at St. John Medical Center. He also is the Medical Director of their hospice program. And John Hendricks, you and I had an interesting quasi-dialogue a while ago. Several years ago, when I was an attending physician at St. John, I was surprised one morning when I had had a patient come in on service with my resident team. The woman was, I believe, 95 years old. She had severe dementia, and she had, like a lot of very elderly folks who are getting pretty infirm, she had fallen and broken her hip. And as a consequence of that, or perhaps maybe as the precursor to that, we don't know, she developed a heart arrhythmia where her heart was beating very fast and her blood pressure was a little bit low. And in any event, the resident very dutifully, you know, got a hold of me as quickly as possible and said, you know, I'm really worried about this patient. In any event, her son appeared, who identified himself as her proxy, and he seemed very confident in that role and very comfortable making the decision or executing his mother's will that she would not want to have a lot of aggressive medical intervention. And we had that discussion in the room with the doctors present and whatever family was available at that time. And then we managed to have that conversation with the orthopedic team. That was obviously the team of doctors whose specialty is repairing the broken hip. And to me, it seemed very reasonable not to repair her hip, given that, you know, she had an underlying dementia. She was not even walking, you know, at baseline. So even before she broke her hip, she was someone who was essentially bedbound or chairbound and was living in a nursing home. And, you know, we had this discussion both inside the room and then, as I said later, outside the room. And then the next day I came in to find out that I had thought the patient had been transferred to like a hospice program or back to her nursing home when in fact she was in the operating room ready to get her hip repaired. And I remember being furious because we'd had this discussion. It seemed like a very clear-cut case. And so I called the operating room, and it turned out that there were some other siblings, two other sisters who had not been present the day before. And then, in fact, the son who'd identified himself as the proxy was really just one of four children. We're all essentially had an equal vote. In any event, I wound up feeling very angry, and I did something that I've never done before that or since, which is as a blogger, I wrote a sort of an angry post, and instead of sort of filing it in the drawer and waiting, I posted it online, not naming names, but just sort of venting my anger at this. And the post went on to get reposted at a national blog called Kevin MD, which is basically a blog that's read by, you know, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of doctors. And you wrote a very intelligent comment in response to my angry post, which I regretted posting. And in fact, I subsequently used this as a teaching exercise in how not to behave professionally, which I still feel guilty about to this day. But the tenor of your reply to my post was essentially that fixing this lady's hip was not actually a complicated medical procedure. It actually involved just putting a pin to hold the bone in place through the skin, which is really about a 15-minute operative procedure, not requiring anesthesia. And then, in fact, it probably was the more humane decision. I was making the case it was inhumane to take an old, demented, frail woman to the operating room, and you were, in fact, arguing quite the opposite. You taught me something that day, which I've never forgotten, that the medical facts were really that it was probably the right thing to do medically, because to treat a broken bone without some kind of stabilizing procedure, she would wind up with certainly being bedbound, secondarily probably not ever moving the leg or using what's called traction, which is basically hanging a weight on the leg to try to get it to heal. Imagine doing that with a person who doesn't have dementia. And she would be at huge risk for what are called decubitus ulcers, where the skin would break down and she'd get infections, and it would certainly probably hasten her dying process. So not to put you on the spot, I just did a long monologue there, but you taught me really about, you know, surgery is not a black box. There's all kinds of different surgeries, and I knew that at the time. I didn't really know that much about orthopedics. I always assumed that hip repairs took a great deal of, anesthesia and time in the operating room. But in fact, and the orthopedic surgeon himself later explained this to me, this was a relatively minor procedure. And in fact, even though you could question doing a surgical procedure at all on a 94-year-old with dementia, this probably was the right thing to do. Do you remember that incident?
I do. I wasn't involved in the case. I do remember reading the blog. And at that time, I was in the ICU, but prior to my ICU time, I helped develop the hip fracture program at St. John, protocol-based to reduce the wait time for going to surgery, improving pain, decreasing delirium. And we've actually had pretty good results with that. Our length of stay has decreased quite a bit. Delirium has decreased. So it was kind of a passion thing for me, and I worked pretty close with the orthopedic surgeons. And when I read that, I was like, well, my concern for this lady is the pain. She has dementia. If she tries to get up out of bed, she's going to have excruciating pain. Pain medications may help, but the easier thing in my mind, especially coming from my background at that time, was to pin the hip. I can treat her with Tylenol and some low-dose pain medicines as needed. But that was kind of my gist when I saw that, and wanted to kind of put in my two cents that maybe the most humane thing was to pin it and let her go on her way at that point. And maybe she won't have a lot of pain and live her happily demented life at that time.
I appreciated the sort of the way you were able to kind of sidestep the emotional aspect of it and really just stick to the teaching point at hand, which was probably that arguably doing the pin was the more humane thing. And of course, there's no right answer, right? I mean, it is much dependent on her preference, which we couldn't really know because of her dementia, but the preference of her children. And in fact, it seemed like, you know, I guess the dialogue I'd had the day prior with the son and one daughter was absolutely she wouldn't have wanted this, whereas the other two daughters felt, it sounds like, completely differently. So these things are very tough, and you know, obviously ethically you walk a fine line in terms of doing or not doing, and these are sort of the things that go on in a hospital every day. And I just appreciated that dialogue, and it was nice to have a chance to catch up with you about that.
Well, I was happy to help you out there.
Well, thank you. So you are now, you've gone in this transition from hospital care, hospital-based care primarily, into intensive care, sort of out of the frying pan, into the fire, now to this more, this role of palliative care in hospice. And, you know, one thing you mentioned is in your design for this accountable care organization look at outpatient palliative care or consult planning, you mentioned 60-minute initial appointments, 30-minute follow-up appointments. And I mean, I think as a listener, I'm hearing that going, wow, I mean, sign me up for that. So is this an acknowledgement that doing this stuff involves a great deal of conversation and delicacy, or that as people approach older age, they need more time with doctors? I mean, where did these magical allotments of time come up when we think about the 12-minute or 15-minute office visit?
I can tell you those times right now are my best guess based off what it requires me in the hospital. The conversations that we're going to have are, yes, we're going to focus on symptoms, but we need to take the time to establish what the patient understands about their disease and where they think things are going and establish their quality of life. And it requires me to sit there and listen to the patient, and I need the time to do that. St. John has been very supportive and understands that this is a time-intensive service. We're not going to be able to turn around the patients quickly, and they understand that. For them, they want to provide good care to their patients, especially in this time, and they feel palliative care will be able to help these patients. We say an hour, we say 30 minutes, it may be longer, it may be shorter, but I want to just make sure that I give plenty of time to my patient and find out what's going on with them and what I can do for them, and I don't want them to feel rushed, and I don't want to feel rushed.
Do you think this is maybe a new standard of care? I mean, as the palliative care field grows, that there's an acknowledgement, as it were, in the sort of in the medical culture that's always more, more, faster, faster, that, hey, we need to kind of take a collective breath and sort of slow things down a little bit?
I do. I think we're starting to see it in what we call care managers. Many of the St. John Physician Clinics now have nurse managers essentially assigned to a certain group of patients. It's like we need to take the time to spend with these patients. There are easy patients to go through quickly. You know, I had the sniffles or I've got a cough. But there are those patients that are chronically ill. Really, we need to spend the time with them. And maybe spending an extra 15 minutes with them will keep them out of the hospital. And I think as budgets start to tighten, reimbursement starts to go away, the hospital realizes, you know, it's best to keep these out of this expensive services that we provide and keep them home and comfortable. And there may be evidence that keeping them home and comfortable, they'll live longer than doing all these things to them.
Well, John Hendricks, thank you so much for your time. John Hendricks is the Medical Director of Palliative Care Services and the St. John Hospice at St. John Medical Center. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. John Hendricks is Medical Director of Palliative Care Services and Hospice at St. John Medical Center in Tulsa. Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. To listen to any of our shows on your own schedule, just go to our website on your computer or mobile device at studiotulsa.org. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.